today on Against the Grain. We hear a lot about immigrant farm workers toiling in the fields, but some of them go on to set up their own farms in the U.S. How do they do it? Why are they doing it? And in what ways are they contributing to alternative food and farming systems? I'm CS. We revisit a conversation with Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern about her book, The New American Farmer, Immigration, Race, and the Struggle for Sustainability, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Many people who immigrate to the U.S. from Central America find work in the fields, growing and cultivating the crops we eat. What attracts less attention are immigrants who go on to establish farms of their own. Immigrant farmers of color, as it turns out, have distinct and distinctive motivations and ambitions and ways of doing things. Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern, a food studies scholar, discovered that although immigrant farmers are committed to alternative food practices, they, the farmers, are often overlooked in the story of local and alternative food. In her new book, Minkoff-Zern asserts that the ideals and practices of these immigrant farmers align in certain ways with the push for a more democratically controlled and less exploitative food system. Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern is an assistant professor in the Food Studies program at Syracuse University. Her new book is The New American Farmer, Immigration, Race, and the Struggle for Sustainability. When Laura Ann joined me recently via Skype, I began by asking what she was trying to do with this book.
In the book, I highlight immigrant farmers, so farmers that have come to the United States that for the most part have worked in agriculture and kind of followed this trajectory of actually coming from being farmers in Mexico and a little bit other parts of Central America, coming to the U.S., working as farm workers in industrial agriculture, and then starting their own farms. So I'm looking at this very particular group of farmers, and in the book I really wanted to show both the structural challenges of immigrants starting their own farms and also in kind of moving their way through this agricultural system, both due to their immigration status, their race, their kind of placement in this system, and also on the other hand, the opportunities and possibilities that they bring with them in terms of building a more ecologically sustainable and socially just food system. I'm trying to balance two different things in the book, which is both the social injustice that they've experienced, and then also the resistance that they've shown us, and in particular, the knowledge that they've brought with them to our food system and to agriculture more broadly.
What was the carryover in terms of the cultures and traditions that they practiced with their families back in, for example, Mexico, the carryover of those traditions to the U.S. as they established their farms and ran their own farms?
I think one of the most striking ways that they use their agricultural techniques and knowledge when they start farms here is the diversity of produce. And that was something pretty universal at the farms that I saw, was that even if they had been, say, working in a monocrop like lettuce or strawberries when they came to the U.S., when they started their own farms, it was really important that they plant a variety of crops because that was familiar to them. That was the type of farming they wanted to do. And they also wanted to make sure that in starting a farming business, they were feeding their families. So food security was definitely part of this. And I found for some farmers, particularly in California, they may start with a lot of diversity and then due to kind of market opportunities, they might start to focus on a smaller selection of crops. But even then, they always had some kind of diverse, you know, garden or kind of crops on the side that they were growing. And very rarely did I see just monocrop agriculture. So one of the defining features was really diversity. And then there were other, you know, defining features like maintaining a family culture on the farm. And so, of course, you know, kids went to school and and the adults were running the farm, but when the kids were out of school or in the summers, the kids were an integral part of the farm, as well as grandparents and aunts and uncles. And so it was very much, you know, while it's definitely a business for them and a livelihood, a way to bring their food and agricultural traditions and ways of teaching their kids about food and health, you know, back into their lives, something they've been divorced from in the migration to the U.S.
So you're mentioning family and kids. What was the situation in terms of the proximity of these farmers to their fields and to their families? And it sounds like these immigrant farmers were not necessarily farming just to make a living, just to make money.
Yeah, I mean, the goal of most of the farmers that I spoke with was to recreate this idea of a family farm. You know, they are selling for market. They're not subsistence farmers. But for them, the dream was to really have this farm where they had a house on the farm. Most of them had not succeeded that. Most of them are farming in very kind of disjointed plots. Many of them have multiple plots they have to drive to, kind of wherever they can get access to land. And but some had succeeded, especially in areas where they had been doing it longer, like Northern Virginia, where they are able to raise their family next to the farm and, you know, incorporate animals, incorporate flowers, and make it more of the way that they remembered their lifestyle in Mexico. And so for them, there is this very cultural element to it. And the way that we usually got into those conversations is I would say, well, you know, why are you staying in farming? This is not the best business to get into, right? I mean, most farms in the U.S. are struggling even with, you know, advantages, even with capital to invest, even with linguistic and racial advantages. And, you know, why would you do this? Because it's so hard. And they said, well, it's more than a business for us. It's about recreating home, recreating a sense of home, and teaching our kids the way that we were raised and giving them these skills around growing food and how to feed themselves. And so it was definitely something more than just a business. And I think that was reflected in how they choose to farm as well.
What proportion of the farmers you spoke with are struggling financially?
I mean, most of them. I mean, most farmers in the U.S. are struggling financially, but obviously farmers that come into it with a lot less capital, with a lot less access to formal education to do things like fill out farm insurance forms, go to the USDA and get grants or loans, are going to be even more financially insecure. So like most other farmers in the U.S., most of them have some kind of off-farm job, at least someone in the household does.
Were the farmers you spoke with interested in doing large-scale farming, for example, in expanding their farms from the small or moderate-sized plots they cultivated?
For the most part, they really weren't. You know, again, back to the idea of having a manageable family farm, most of them were also very reasonable in their ideas of what a successful business was. It wasn't just get bigger and bigger. For the most part, they were selling to direct markets, which is pretty labor-intensive, you know, to farmers' markets. And, you know, back to the idea of a family farm, a place where they could teach their kids, where they could spend time, they really wanted to keep labor manageable. So either just family or very few other hired workers on the farm. Yeah, and so keeping a small to mid-size farm was really their goal. There wasn't the idea of becoming a big industrial farm. And, you know, many of them had seen the types of industrial agriculture that we have in the United States, and they've worked in that type of agriculture, and that wasn't what they wanted to do. In fact, it was very different. And so when I first started this research, when I told people I was talking to farm workers that had started their own farms, and many of them were still going to do field work during the day as hired workers, then they would do this after their job. And people would say, well, that just seems like then they do the same job all day. But in fact, it looked very, very different. So they might be on the back of a tractor, you know, planting garlic all day. But when they go to their own farm, they're planting a diversity of crops. They're doing lots of different jobs. They're making decisions. And you can only do that on a certain scale, right? Once you scale up to bigger and bigger, you have to simplify your farming practices. And you're more likely to become a monocrop farm or, you know, a few crops. And that really wasn't the goal. The goal was to farm in a different way than they had been doing as workers in the U.S.
Any sense of the average amount of time the immigrant farmers you spoke with worked as farm workers in the U.S. before setting up their own farms?
It varied, probably 5 to 10 years. And it wasn't so much that they needed industrial agricultural experience. It was a matter of being in the U.S. long enough to kind of establish, understand systems here, get some English under their belt, understand the markets, that kind of thing. So, yeah, most of them had worked in industrial agriculture for at least several years. And some had worked, you know, in industrial agriculture in Mexico before they came here, too.
You write that many farmers come from families that couldn't afford to use chemicals on their farms in Mexico. Does that background give these immigrant farmers a leg up in non-chemical farming practices? And in fact, did they tend to, or do they tend to pursue those kinds of practices in the U.S.?
Yeah, absolutely. They definitely have a particular advantage in that the way that many of them, not all of them, the way that many of them farmed in Mexico, you know, was very similar to organic or sustainable practices here. And so while it's difficult for many of them to go through the process of getting certified organic for a host of reasons, you know, using low off-farm inputs or low agrochemical inputs was something that came easily to them because that was how they had grown up farming. They knew how to do things, you know, like compost, turn the soil, rotate crops. It was the way that they learned to farm. So they definitely had those skills. And some of them even said specifically, well, you know, I only learned the word organic when I moved here, but my father was organic, my brothers are organic. And when I spoke with there are a few organizations that I worked with and met farmers through that specifically train immigrants to farm in the United States. And one of the trainers that does, you know, agricultural education in these programs said, you know, they come here knowing organic farming, and that's something that we're trying to grow organic farming or sustainable farming. And they actually come here with that knowledge. And that's something that, you know, our food system should be taking advantage of if we want to be growing a sustainable food system.
That's the voice of Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern. She's assistant professor in the food studies program at Syracuse University, and she's author of The New American Farmer, Immigration, Race, and the Struggle for Sustainability. It's out recently from the MIT Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So many of the immigrant farmers that you talked to for this book, they grew diverse crop mixes, so they opted against the sort of monocropping tendency of industrial farms. They didn't use chemicals or didn't use lots of chemicals on their plants, on their crops. This sounds like, and I know you would agree with this, kind of alternative food practices, alternative farming practices. To what extent were these farmers conscious of the kind of alternative food movement? And did they participate? Did they try and actively participate in those kinds of movements because of what they were doing with their fields?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I looked at. Absolutely, the form of farming in terms of the practices you just mentioned, diversity, low agrochemical input, small-scale farming, you know, farming primarily with labor from within the family is all what we think of in terms of alternative agriculture. And there is a huge alternative agriculture, sustainable agriculture movement in the United States, and people coming together, you know, trying to advocate for more support, trying to change consumers to be, you know, buying more from these types of farms. I didn't so much see that they identified with this movement, and I think part of that is that, for the most part, the alternative farming movement has been primarily among white farmers, and I think there's been a huge shift. California has been ahead of the game in that, for sure. But, you know, outside of just going to the same farmers markets, I saw that they socially were still really just within their own group of immigrant farmers in terms of sharing any resources or working together or identifying. And I will say, when sometimes I'd say, well, are you interested in organizations or, you know, meetings or working with our farmers, a lot of them weren't interested. I think, you know, for a lot of them, farming is something they do because they like working by themselves. And, you know, farming doesn't tend to be a very social way of life. But then for others that are more interested, I think they feel socially isolated from that movement because they don't have the linguistic skills and they are identified as workers. You know, when they go into offices, when they go to conferences, people don't think that they own their own farm. And so I think they're very much being overlooked by the alternative farming movement and have been for a long time when, you know, I think they're a very important part of it. And I know there is a lot of changing awareness around racial dynamics among alternative farmers and sustainable farmers. And I think there's a lot of intention there. But for, you know, the 70 plus farmers I talked to, I wouldn't say any of them felt particularly involved in the alternative farming movement, at least not yet.
So are you referring to, in part, kind of the whiteness of the narratives and images that the alternative food movement tends to use?
Yeah, absolutely. And whether that's, you know, marketing in the grocery store or kind of the face of the new young farmer that, you know, you see in a documentary, it's a hard shift for people to start seeing that the people that actually have been working in the fields are part of that movement too, that many of them own their own farms, that many of the new and beginning farmers are not just white farmers. And like I said, I think that conversation has been started, but it's taken a while. But yeah, absolutely, the imagery of who is the new alternative farmer has not included immigrants as those farmers.
What about seed saving? Was that something they practiced as well?
You know, I did not see a lot of seed saving. I saw some crops, like some specific herbs that people would bring from their home country, from Mexico or Central America. And those were some pretty specific, you know, just herbs that they couldn't find here. But there wasn't a lot of seed saving going on year to year on the farm. And I think it's because seed saving is incredibly labor intensive and it's almost a production in and of itself. And that so many varieties are actually available to them by catalog now, you know, even a lot of the specific varieties that they're looking for. So I don't think in terms of, you know, because they are running businesses, I don't think it's really worth a lot of the time investment for them with all the other things they have to do on the farm.
Let's return to this issue of family farming and having the family, living with the family on the farm or near the farm, which is what these people like to do, and it's totally understandable. Are the family, well, first of all, what family members tend to be used as labor on these farms? And I'm also wondering whether they are paid, whether they're paid wages.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're pointing out some of the holes in idealizing anything regarding family labor. And I try not to do that in the book. But typically what I saw was, you know, a husband and wife couple, sometimes just a single man or a single woman. And if they had any teenager adult children, they'd be helping, you know, when they were available. Sometimes they had children that had grown up helping on the farm that had, you know, were in their early 20s and were integral parts of the farm. Some of them had elderly parents, you know, in their 50s, 60s that were working on the farm with them. Or like any farm, they'd have some cousins, aunts, and uncles come in at particular times in the season. You know, as for if those family members got paid, it depended on if they were part of the nuclear family or not. So if it was their child or their parent that lived with them. But definitely I heard of, you know, some of them would say that they paid their cousin or their brother and sister that didn't live with them. Sometimes it was a matter of splitting up the produce. You know, so there were different types of arrangements. But certainly just because it's family labor doesn't mean that it's, you know, inherently socially just. Obviously, there's all types of power imbalances among families. And that's not something I got too much into in my interviews. But typically what I saw is if I asked to speak to the farmer, I would speak with a male and I would try and make an effort, you know, to see if oftentimes there'd be a female in the background cooking or doing something to see, you know, if we can bring other people into the conversation. It's a sensitive thing when you're in someone's home.
Yeah.
Oftentimes I'd find if the female partner started chiming in and I started asking questions, she'd come sit down and very much ran the farm as well. So
did some of the, and I'm thinking maybe of the younger people on the farm, the children, say, of the farmers, did they say anything about whether they would prefer being paid if they were not, in fact, being paid?
It's not a question I asked, and I also didn't have, this was a study focused on adults. So in terms of research, I was not doing interview with anyone under 18. So I wasn't really able to ask questions regarding, how the kids mm-hmm. felt about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I will say if they were kids on the farm, they weren't always working. A lot of times you'd see, an older child watching a younger child play at the farm on the weekend, or a grandparent playing with kids, or a toddler napping on the side under the shade. And I think what that really contributed to wasn't so much that they were like intense laborers, but it was the sense that they wanted the farm to be a place for the kids to be present and to be part of the process. And many of them lived in apartment buildings and said, we don't get, our kids don't have places to play outside and get exercise. And this is our place now. This is a place where our kids can be, where they can learn about, food, where that we can teach them our culture and traditions. And I think it also really influenced, if they wanted to spray pesticides or fertilizers on their crops, because they were aware that their kids were there. And many of them mentioned that as well, which is, I want this to be a healthy place. And I've experienced what it's like to work in a place with chemicals. And I don't want that for my kids.
Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern joins me. She teaches in the food studies program at Syracuse University. We are talking about her book, The New American Farmer. We'll take a short music break and return and speak more with Laura Ann about this really interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern joins me. She's assistant professor in the food studies program at Syracuse University, and she's author of The New American Farmer, Immigration, Race, and the Struggle for Sustainability. Her book examines the experiences of Latinx immigrant farmers as they transition from farm workers to farm owners, offering a new perspective on racial issues and racial inequity and sustainable farming. So one question you take up in this book, Laura Ann, is whether these immigrant farmers could be seen as challenging capitalist imperatives in certain ways. And one thing you consider is the fact that some of the farmers did hire non-family workers for a wage, and that some of these farmers prided themselves on their treatment of their workers. So, these people were at one point farm workers working for other people, not necessarily treated in the best way. And now they own their farms, or they run their farms, and now they are hiring other people for a wage to do their work. What was your sense of how they treated their workers? I'm guessing it might have been hard to get an accurate picture of that. And whether the farmers were, if they were trying to, were successfully going against the way in which capitalist exploitation often operates.
I think when it comes to farm worker wages and farm worker treatment, I look at that as a structural issue, which comes down to the fact that farmers really make such a small percent of the profits from the food that they grow as compared to the processors, retailers, transporters of that food. So farmers are structurally constrained in terms of how much they can pay. And that's not to say that there are not some very exploitative, explicitly racist farmers out there. You know, and definitely some of the farm workers I spoke with talked about that. I mean, it's no secret that there are some very bad exploitative working conditions for farm workers. That said, the ability to pay higher wages is dependent upon having more money. And so what I saw with immigrant farmers that had experienced, you know, this structural exploitation themselves, many of them, is they didn't actually have the means to pay their workers more than they had been paid. And so that's something I think that's oftentimes overlooked in the alternative food movement, is that supporting smaller local agriculture doesn't inherently mean that workers have better wages and benefits. And so it's complex. So on one hand, immigrant farmers, you know, they just basic level, they speak the language as their workers. Oftentimes they have a personal relationship with their workers, be that their cousin or their friend. The people that they did hire, if they had hired workers, were in their community. So there's a relationship there that's different. That said, their ability to pay higher wages or, say, you know, give health benefits is no better than the white farmer down the street. You know, one thing I went into this project hoping for is this kind of a solution towards the labor injustice problem. And the answer is really no, because the financial and labor exploitation of workers in the farm workers in the food system is really based on larger structural issues. And so even farmers that want to pay workers better oftentimes can't. And certainly when you're looking at more economically marginalized farmers, their ability to do that is even less. And so while certainly I think working for someone that speaks your language and knows your culture and has, you know, some kind of relationship with you leads towards better treatment day to day, it doesn't mean that you make more money or have more benefits or more security. So really, they're stuck in the same system as everyone else. Well, I think that they, in terms of representation, this is important. In terms of them gaining control over their own labor, this is important. But they don't, their existence doesn't solve the structural problems of the capitalist food system.
Did they try and provide benefits to their workers?
There were a few. I mean, especially the farmers that had done it for much longer. So there are a few farmers I interviewed in California, in Washington State, in Virginia, you know, a little bit everywhere, that had been just more established farmers that had made more money and that really prioritized, you know, the ones that had been there longer also tended to have more workers. They were just more established. And there were some that said, yeah, I really do this. And I think that's impressive, because most farmers don't, you know, and they really prioritize the treatment of their workers. But I think for most of them, they don't even have health insurance themselves. So, which is, again, true of a lot of farmers, especially small scale ones. So I think it's a matter of what they can do economically for many of them, even if they have good intentions. It's just very difficult.
So this issue of, you know, them not being able to maybe treat their workers in the way they want, because they are, as you said, subject to capitalist pressures, subject to market pressures. What about pressures to go non-alternative? Will immigrant farmers be able to resist market pressures to shift to more conventional industrial methods?
Yeah, I absolutely saw that happening. And that was really based on regional differences. So for example, in the Bay Area in California, it's very hard to get into the high-end farmers markets. I even heard tell of like a black market of spots to get in, which
wow.
I can't confirm those, but it was something that I was told about. But that it's very difficult to get into these high-end markets, and, you know, to make money and to pay for the cost of transportation of their produce, they need to prioritize high-end markets. And for many new farmers, that's just not possible, especially if they don't have the social networks as U.S.-born farmers and they don't have the language skills. So I saw for those that couldn't get into these markets, if you can't sell in a farmer's market or a CSA model, and you don't have the networks with all of the high-end restaurants for your specialty crops, or it's just very saturated in certain regions of the country, more so on the West Coast than the East Coast, where there's just less alternative farmers, then the pressure is to, move towards monocrop agriculture, move towards a way of growing where you can just sell to the middle buyers. That was something that many of them didn't want to do, but just found was more practical, you know, selling to the shippers rather than directly, which is kind of what they wanted. And some of them had to make that transition from something really diverse, you know, to some of them just saying, all right, I have to specialize in heirloom tomatoes. That's how I'm going to make a living. I saw that much more in the markets in California and a bit in Washington State. On the East Coast, we don't have the same saturation of farmers and in the farmers markets. It's not as hard to get in. It's not as competitive. The standards are just different. So I wasn't hearing that as much on the East Coast.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern joins me via Skype. She teaches in the Food Studies program at Syracuse University. We are talking about her new book, The New American Farmer: Immigration, Race, and the Struggle for Sustainability. You write, Laura Ann, that immigrant farmers struggle against deep-rooted racial and ethnic agrarian hierarchies. And many of these hierarchies are rooted in history, in U.S. history. Now, this is a big question, of course, but can you lay out some of what you mean by the hierarchies and the discrimination that puts immigrant farmers of color at a disadvantage?
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things I usually talk about is just the way that the cases within the United States Department of Agriculture, where we've seen structural discrimination actually admitted to by the agency. So for African American farmers, for Native American farmers, for female farmers, and for Hispanic Latino farmers, there have been lawsuits that have been settled in different ways, either through a class action settlement or a claims settlement, dependent on the group. But that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg. That's just in terms of farmers applying for loans and not getting them or being discouraged from applying. And so I think that this type of discrimination happens in many different agricultural spaces, in that, you know, people of color, whether it be historically African-American farmers who, you know, have been dispossessed of land that they have had, you know, at the same time in the civil rights movement, Black farmers in the South were losing land on massive scales due to a lot of the discrimination in the United States Department of Agriculture from other farmers. You know, African American farmers were seen as a threat in terms of taking over agriculture from white farmers and being competitors. And I think that Latino farmers are having the same struggle. And I heard that directly from some of the farmers that I talked to, that, you know, the issue wasn't the customers, it was the other farmers. They don't like to see people that worked for them becoming their competitors. And so there was kind of this direct discrimination from farmers that, you know, had their community and they had the farmers they were used to, and they didn't really like to see this new crop of farmers, or they wouldn't extend the same support to them that they would their neighbors. But then also, you know, I could sense it when I called the USDA offices, I'd call local offices and say, you know, I'm doing some research with Latino farmers in your area. Can I talk to someone that might know a little bit about this? And they'd say, well, we don't work with farm workers. And I'd say, well, I'm not talking about farm workers. I'm talking about immigrant farmers. And, you know, there were some offices that actually did, particularly in Washington State, people that could talk to me about it, and other offices where they just kind of couldn't even acknowledge that they were there. And so it still exists today that they're this unseen population, and that's reinforced, you know, through these linguistic and cultural barriers. And when I went and talked to farmers markets managers, even, you know, many of them were supportive, but many of them would say, oh, well, you know, they don't really follow the rules the same way. You know, we have to kind of watch them a little bit more. Most people aren't being intentionally racist, right? But there was a sense of they're not as trustworthy. They, you know, they don't, it's not the same as with the white farmers. And so I think there's this historical bias against different groups of people of color, and they're contending with that right now.
Do you think some of these immigrant farmers of color are being judged by the fact that they don't play into the industrial agri-food model of farming?
I think the spaces that they are marketing and the spaces that they're occupying are alternative food spaces. So, I mean, in some ways that could be happening, maybe by some of the other local farmers, but when they go to farmers markets, it's, which is where most of them sell, that's the way that most people are farming, is some type of alternative agriculture, smaller scale. So I don't think it's so much because they're alternative farmers, but I think it's even within the alternative farming spaces that they are struggling.
You put the immigrant farmers you spoke with, you present them kind of in relation to alternative food movements and practices. We've talked a bit about that. You also bring up the food sovereignty movement. And you ask whether these farmers kind of fit within it, or what their role might be within it, or what their potential role could be within the food sovereignty movement. Remind us what food sovereignty is.
Yeah, food sovereignty is a movement started by a farmer, an international farmer group, Livia Campesina, in response to unfair trade agreements and practices on a global scale that's really dispossessed small-scale farmers and peasants from their land and their ability to have control over food and their food system. And so it's a movement that's saying, you know, it's going beyond something like food security, which is that we should all have access to a healthy amount of nutritious food. It's saying, well, not only that, but we should be able to have access to that food while also having more control over where that food comes from, who grows it, the quality and way in which that is grown. So it's a deeper sense of food access and incorporates agriculture in that definition.
And what is your sense of whether food sovereignty is something the immigrant farmers you spoke with are actively or consciously working toward?
A lot of food sovereignty is defined in terms of control over one's food system and access to food. And that's what I think these farmers have really succeeded at, is they've gone from being industrial farm workers with very little control over the food that they eat, being part of producing food, but having no control over how that food is produced and what kind of food it is and those practices, to, you know, while they're vulnerable and they're struggling, you know, economically, they have moved to a place of actually making decisions about the type of food that's being produced in their community, about what kind of access they have, about what varieties they grow. You know, and this is all within the context of market capitalism. I mean, they're not functioning in some kind of alternative system by any means. But I think that they represent, you know, part of that movement is regaining control over their own labor, regaining control over their own food production, and contributing to that type of control within their own community, and providing healthier, more sustainably produced food for people around them as well.
Did they tend to hope or expect that their children will grow up to become farmers themselves and perhaps take over their farms?
You know, not necessarily, and I did always ask that. Like I said, there are some farms where the adult children are already part of it, and very integrated into the farm, and children that had gone to high school in the United States that speak English, that really have some important skills that they contribute to the farm, that are really choosing to be involved. For those farmers whose kids were either much younger or whose kids were older but not involved in the farm, there was never a sense of, you know, this is their obligation or this is what I want for them. It was always, you know, if this is what they choose, then I have something to offer. Or even if I've just taught them, you know, how to grow food, they'll always have that, right? They can always feed themselves from what I've given them. There wasn't a sense of pressuring their kids into it. And, you know, some of them would say, no, I have a daughter who's a dental hygienist. You know, I'm so proud of her. There wasn't a sense that their kids had to follow in their footsteps.
Did the farmers you spoke with want to stay in the U.S., or did some of them want to eventually return to Mexico?
Yeah, it was really an interesting mix, and I think it depended on the age of the farmer. For those that were younger, like in their 20s or 30s, and had younger children, this is their home, you know, and this is where they were establishing their life and their family, and they had immigrated more recently, and so they had really given up a lot to be here, and having a farm was a way of making a home here and feeling at home. And there wasn't so much talk of going back because they really had left a life that wasn't, it wasn't possible for them to stay. For those that came much earlier, like the 80s, and there were some, you know, that had come in the late 70s and through the 80s and early 90s, that were closer to retirement age and had been sending money home for a long time. Some of them still have land in Mexico. Some of them had been contributing money towards a family farm this entire time and said, yeah, well, eventually maybe, you know, I'll retire back in Mexico. Those are farmers that were more established and had the ability to go back and forth, right? They were documented. So I think it really depended.
So you're saying by contributing, they were sending remittances back to Mexico, back to family members in Mexico?
Yes. And most of them are doing that in some form.
What about land prices, right? It's hard enough to buy a house in some parts, many parts of the country. Was owning the land where they would either cultivate or live, was that too pricey for some of these farmers?
So again, that really depended on the region. So obviously, California is not a place. I mean, California, most farmers rent land. Many, many of them do. Washington State's also more expensive. So in those places, people were more likely to be renting land, and there wasn't even really a sense that they could buy a farm, really. And they were satisfied somewhat with that. In places like Virginia, you know, Minnesota, New York, depending on where they were in New York, buying land was much more plausible. And particularly in Virginia, the community that I spoke with there was this community that had been, I spoke with about 25 farmers in that region that had all come from Jalisco in the 80s, and most of them owned land, and they were very established, really different than newer immigrants in places like California that were just renting 4 or 5 acres and really didn't see buying land as an option. It was a matter of how much can I rent and how do I get water access?
Catalina, a farmer in Virginia that you spoke with, and is part of this book, she said that she found life in the U.S. very, very ugly. What did she mean by that? And was she able to escape that kind of life as she perceived it on her farm?
Yeah, that was a really wonderful interview where I sat in her living room, and she actually owned her land in Virginia and sold flowers along with vegetables at the farmer's market. So we were looking out at this incredible field of flowers. And she was just talking about the pace of life for her. She had grown up in a rural part of Mexico. And for her, her farm was recreating, you know, that the livelihood and the way of life that she had experienced. And she said, you know, in the United States, things are just so fast paced. I felt for so many years that this just wasn't, you know, this wasn't home because of that. And for her, having her farm was a way to recreate her home and provide that for her kids. And so a lot of it is just about an agrarian livelihood. And yeah, she really seemed to feel that she was succeeding in that.
Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern, she's assistant professor in the food studies program at Syracuse University, author of The New American Farmer, Immigration, Race, and the Struggle for Sustainability. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you present a number of recommendations in this book, things that we can do, that the authorities can do, that movements can do. One thing you emphasize is that actors and activists in the alternative food system must recognize immigrant farmers as playing an integral role in alternative food production. Why is that important?
Well, I think that immigrant farmers already have the skills that we're looking for. You know, I think what we see time and time again is, you know, college-educated, white, new, beginning farmers. There's a movement of them across the United States. I was aspiring to be one at one point, are being trained in places across the coasts. And not to say that they shouldn't be doing that, but they're trying to learn all these very challenging skills and a livelihood that doesn't come easy to many of us. Whereas we have this entire population of workers that actually know how to do this, that have spent their life doing this, that want to do this. What they don't have access to is formal education, access to the market, capital to invest. And I think turning towards, you know, the farm workers that have this experience to be teaching us, right? I mean, they're those that are in the United States and want to stay in the United States and are established here to transition our agricultural system to one that's more, you know, ecologically sustainable. that's a potential that we have to make that change.
Beyond perhaps some of these alternative food movement folks seeing more farmers of color and beginning to understand that, no, we're encountering not farm workers, but farmers, established farmers, what can movements and activists do to become maybe more inclusive or more race conscious in the way they organize and the way they go about their business?
So I actually really am starting to see that transition happen. And as I said, I do think it has been happening. I think that the conferences and spaces that host actors in the alternative agriculture movement, from farmers to nonprofits, have become much more race conscious and have been inviting farmers of color to speak at those conferences and be a very visible presence. I will say that the immigrant farming community that I specifically have been working with, so in particular, first generation non-English speaking immigrants that are not already networked in to these spaces because they don't have the ability to speak English, because they're not so in the same social spaces, they're not as present in these spaces still. So I think it involves still more reaching out. And what's hard is that the immigrant farmers I've talked to aren't already networked in. So I don't know. I mean, it's a challenge. So on one hand, I think it's already happening, and I think organizations have been making a really concerted effort to make sure that conferences and other spaces are more inclusive. I think it's difficult because immigrant farmers, first-generation immigrant farmers, are very socially isolated as well.
And what about efforts by, for example, government agencies and maybe nonprofits to help immigrant farmers, to provide training and support? What changes do you think could be done to help and make it easier for these immigrant farmers of color to succeed?
Yeah, I mean, I think things like being aware of what has been translated into multiple languages or not, things like the standards for organic farming, making sure that grants and loans have been translated into Spanish, making sure that there are bilingual staff available in organizations as well as government agencies. Unfortunately, since I started my research, we've gone backwards at the federal level in terms of documents being available in Spanish. Some of the Spanish documents were actually wiped off the USDA website and were put in archives and not renewed in Spanish. But I have hope that we're going to go in a better direction, you know, in terms of at least organizations are currently becoming more aware of that type of support. And so, you know, having things translated, having people available that, you know, that not just speak Spanish, but that understand and are from immigrant communities. One of the most successful places I saw this happening was Washington State, where it just so happened that one of the loan officers had grown up in a farm worker, actually two of them had grown up in farm worker families, and one of them was the son of one of the most successful immigrant farmers in the region. And he was networked in that community, and therefore immigrant farmers in that community knew what was available to them. And it was really unique, but it shows that when people are hired from immigrant communities to play roles in organizations and in, you know, state-based agencies, that you can reach these communities. And a lot of it is, you know, networking outside of people's comfort zones and making sure that they hear what opportunities are available, you know. So oftentimes if I met with people in USDA, local USDA offices, I'd say, oh, well, you know, how do you reach out to people? And they'd say, oh, well, we send out emails to people that are already on our email list. Or, well, they could walk in, but unless we have 20% participation in another language, nothing is translated, or we don't get a translator. So there's a lot of just linguistic and cultural barriers up right now to immigrant farmers just accessing the same basic resources that other farmers are accessing.
You, Laura Ann, are interested in deep structural changes to our food system. Do you see immigrant farmers from places like Mexico adding or providing some kind of momentum to such structural changes, or do you see those changes as too difficult to achieve in today's political economic environment?
That's a hard question. I mean, I think the changes are happening, right, despite our political and economic environment. there's a broad-based push for, you know, more ecologically sustainable food systems. That's happening despite climate denial. We know that agriculture is a huge part of contributing to climate change. So I think the push for more sustainable food systems is just going to continue. We have a group of people that has that knowledge that wants to be doing this work. And I think another thing that gives me hope in terms of how immigrant farmers are going to succeed is that, you know, many white farmers are retiring and saying, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. Kids that are growing up on farms don't want to get into the business. And we have a group of farmers that wants to do this if they're supported, right? If we make it possible. So, while on one hand, we do need large structural change, which is quite intimidating, I think that there are other ways that we can see hopeful change being made on smaller incremental level in terms of supporting farmers like this, you know, putting back in supports and funding for the types of markets that they sell in. So farmers markets, grants to get organic certification, things like that, that will allow these farmers to succeed and make that the shift that is so important. So no, I mean, those aren't huge structural changes. And I think we have a long way to go. And honestly, those are big policy changes that have to be made. You know, I do see there are places that are leading the policy change. So California had a bill passed to support farmers of color and to reduce discrimination and increase supports. And I think, you know, that's tremendous because it means that it's going to happen across the board, or has been. So far, I think they're the only state that's done that. And obviously, getting those changes made at a federal level aren't going to happen right now. But I hope that in the future, that's the direction we go.
Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern, MinkoffZern, assistant professor in the food studies program at Syracuse University. We've been talking about her book, The New American Farmer, Immigration, Race, and the Struggle for Sustainability. It's just out from the MIT Press. Laura Ann, thank you so much for writing this book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that interview first aired on March 11th of this year. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.